Okay, we're going to go ahead and start this session. And this will be fun because often when I was just talking a moment ago with Denise, often when you're talking, you have a large formal group and it's hard to get really intimate and comfortable. So this will be fun. We can ask lots of questions, share lots of information. And just in the 2 seconds that I was introducing myself to her, I thought I could spend this whole time just asking her questions about herself because she sounds like a very, very interesting woman. Denise was born in Austria. She went to Switzerland, joined the church in Switzerland, came to BYU, met a husband, got married, had a military career. Her husband was in the
Navy.
They spent their life raising 4 children in the military, retired, came to Bethesda, where he retired from the military and now works for her. She is a gemologist, has a company that sells pearls and gems to jewelry stores. She also has private clients that work directly for her. So I thought this is the ideal thing. You work with your husband for a long time and then he works for you. Perfect. And so it sounds, and she does a lot of time traveling. Obviously, she has many varied interests and she's not just a one-issue person. She's been speaking, I think, 4 times in the last week in Thailand to gemologists in several different places, and so this is kind of fun for us to see what she has done in all of these other areas, and then for her to share hopefully a wide background of information, but specifically, I'll read the little spiel in our paper so that for the people on the tape, they will have the specific information about who she is and what she does. So Denise Nelson lives in Bethesda, Maryland. She's the director of SERVE, which is Support and Education for Radiation Victims, which of course should be very interesting for those of us from Utah who have some big issues about that. She's a graduate gemologist and appraiser, and she's the owner of the Inner Circle, Fine Jewelry Importing and Sales. So, broad background, very interesting, and thank you for sharing this with us.
Thank you very much, Kathy. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm really thrilled to have this nice little intimate group of people here today. It's a lot easier for me to make mistakes and not feel like I need to dive under the table. Do What Is Right is the topic of my lecture today. And I chose that because of basically of what this country has gone through the last 2 years. We are at a point in time that we really probably didn't plan to be at 3 or 4 years ago. This the way of the world affairs today, I'm sure, have affected all of us. And doing what is right, that little Mormon song that we sometimes sing in Sunday school, really struck it with me even years ago. The ethics of Mormonism are always something that have really appealed to me. The values, the morals, what we choose to do about ourselves, about our own lives, about our own families, and what we do to make the world a better place. So this is a topic that I feel very comfortable with because I've always felt that it is almost an integral part of being Mormon is to do something that is good for society as a whole. I had no idea how those words would affect me. Do what is right, let the consequence follow. All the words in that song, if you ever read over it, are very, very specific and very, very clear. I would remember these words at a very difficult time of my life. 8 years ago, I started on a journey which I do not wish on anyone, but I do believe should be experienced by more of us. Women tend to often nurture and care, but rarely speak out bluntly about problems, politics, or other touchy or hefty subjects. I do like peace and calm and everything in order, and pretty surroundings, as well as little stress as possible. My priorities, however, changed almost overnight. At a community meeting, my husband and I attended it It sounded interesting. It talked about the issues and the facts about traffic, about how your community is affected by various outside influences. And at this meeting, we heard about an incinerator. My husband, being a physical chemist, loved the topic. He thought it was very interesting. What he didn't like was the idea of that three incinerators had been burning within 1 mile of our house for 20 years. He was very much alarmed by this, and very few people even know that they were there. They had, what it made the issue even worse was is that they had operated without proper oversight, in violation of state regulations, state and federal regulations, ignored completely by county and state health officials, and was improperly maintained. The air and water had not been monitored, and the original waste intended for burning at this facility had changed dramatically over the years. Metal sharps, radioactive waste, plastic, styrofoam, rubber, paper, and carcasses were all burned together without any responsible analysis of the particles falling on my neighborhood and the surrounding 11 miles. The advice of a friend was not to waste my time fighting an untouchable giant named NIH, the National Institutes of Health. I never had been called an activist, but NIH quickly gave that title to anyone who questioned anything. NIH documents that I located clearly showed the possibility of negative health effects to the community, dangers to the water supply, and clear and deliberate ignorance of warnings and concerns from engineers, workers, and incinerator specialists. The incinerator workers had been refused hepatitis shots by the most famous institute of health in the world. To shorten this very long and involved tale of fighting windmills and come to what I consider the core and vital part of this experience is what follows. I, along with 12 others who had formed a task force, we were threatened, humiliated, lied to repeatedly in front of press and public, ridiculed, patronized for taking on a $10 million saint who could do no wrong. $10 billion saint, not million. I lost friends and I gained new ones. I saw people lose their job for speaking their mind. And I saw people who covered up wrongdoings rewarded with promotions. I saw specialists called to committees just to have their advice ignored, but their names used to justify actions which helped no one. I saw and listened to a so-called professional environmental engineer hired and endorsed and paid tens of thousands of dollars to oversee soil tests, which were reported as clean before they even were submitted for testing. Later, this consultant turned out a professional con artist. Without any engineering degree, she claimed to have an environmental engineering degree, with an income of several million dollars annually, she misrepresented and deceived people professionally. The way she did this was that she went around the country to EPA Superfund sites, was hired by green groups, and recommended by green groups to the grassroots people, who then recommended to have her be hired, using EPA funds, clean to anything other than leave. The counties that she, there was a Pennsylvania county that she did this to, and we didn't know this until later, and it is still a Superfund site to this day, and no cleanup took place ever because the EPA basically said the money was spent. Ironically, this person had come highly recommended as an independent consultant by a trusted green group to us, who, as later was revealed, was fully aware of her actions and may have even received a financial kickback. A year or so later, she was banned from further government contracting and has not been heard from since. What was the strangest aspect of this was that the NIH had been fully aware of her lack of expertise in the environmental testing field at the time that they had hired her. When taking on a battle, Be aware that you will see the worst in people, and also the best. Indeed, fighting for what you believe in is a constant battle in our world. Without a reporter in our area, somebody who lived locally and who took this issue upon her shoulders, without a reporter who diligently searched for facts and reported on our progress, the public would have never found out what was happening just miles from their homes. I learned to respect the press. Newsweek magazine, which published a letter that I had written, along with the director of NIH's letter, who he had written, the Washington Post, the Almanac, and most of all, the incredible editors of our local newspaper, the Gazette. They received threats and attacks and came through it all with incredible dedication for free speech and environmental concerns. Politicians gathered and dispersed depending on where they saw a benefit to themselves. Senator Dennis, Governor Glenn Denning, Barbara Mikulski were the few of them who strongly and consistently supported our efforts. In the end, compromises were made. The public was never to find out what levels of mercury, radioactive particles, dioxins, and arsenic were dispersed for 30 years of emissions. But 12 people closed down 3 incinerators. And as a result of our actions, NIH now has a public relations office. They implemented a reuse and recycle program, and they use 25% less radioactive substances than 5 years ago. And they have replaced most of their contaminated topsoil from their campus. They still will not admit that they did anything wrong. It was an experience that was not exactly pleasant. Nor did I ever think I would find myself in such an experience. But I would never want to live without it. The rewards are more internal, and therefore explained the lack of jubilance when the incinerators were finally dismantled. It was not the day that one would call the end story. It came after a meeting where it was announced incinerators would be shut down. Many people who didn't know the whole story were very happy about this. And so we, as a small group, really couldn't go on record saying we want them kept open. But we needed to have them be open for one more week before they could test the stack emissions. And that was something that they were very clear about announcing to the public. They were going to close them. What the public did not know is that thereby they avoided all sorts of testing of the stack emissions. So our win was very much a double-edged sword to us. We did not feel like we had won. And that is something that you have to allow yourself, whatever the topic, whatever the job is that you're working on, you have to allow yourself to feel like you have won along the way. I learned more about incinerators than I ever thought I was capable of. I found out who I could trust and who I could not. I found out that no matter how large the task one chooses, with relentless daily commitment, the task becomes doable. It is not whether we win at what we set out to do, but it is about doing. No matter how small our part or how incapable we view ourselves, it is about doing what is right and not looking the other way, no matter how tempting or how profitable it may be. But most of it, it is about losing fear and doing what is right. The only thing necessary for evil to prevail is for good man to do nothing. This was said by Edmund Burke. Not all of us are born activists. In fact, most of us are not. In my case, it was something which could endanger the health of my immediate family. For others, all it may take is the face of a starving child on TV, to see an abused wife struggle, or seeing elderly people who are neglected, to make them active, to give them the boost and compassion to get involved and change things. Many people choose to better the world from far away, detaching themselves by choosing issues they will never get actually involved in. Sending a check, helping someone, most often an organization as a middleman, far, far away. But charity does start at home. But often the needs of our own, in our own backyard, tend to be ignored, because a cause may be more fashionable and accepted by our peers. While I was working on the incinerator issue, one thing became crystal clear, that organizations are not the entities which change things. It is indeed that of the individual person. Actually, organizations often get in the way and take over the efforts without ever reaching the ultimate goal set by those who start the movement. Prospective financial gain for these professional organizations, like the Sierra Club, like the Physicians for Social Responsibility, and many others, are big if they can get an issue into the popular limelight. It is, however, rarely the most successful, since they often make compromises involving finances rather than having the actual affected victims as their priority. There are many organizations, however, which are truly supportive to people like you and me who start grassroots movements and also who are single in their endeavor, maybe out there in the middle of the country. Organizations whose names we rarely hear, like the Clearinghouse for Hazardous Waste, which is a local place, and I brought some publications with me. You're welcome to take them. I've got a whole stack from them. They're a wonderful resource. And also the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. We obviously never have heard of these organizations, but these are two very great resources for anyone choosing to work on environmental or radioactive topics. These organizations were indeed incredibly helpful in providing information at no cost to us and assistance to our little group. They did not benefit in any financial way from becoming involved. At one of our public meetings, we met an attorney who volunteered to come and speak, named Jonathan Turley, from George Washington University. And some of you may have heard of him. He often is called in as an expert whenever there is something having to do with politics on TV, to have an analysis of ethics in politics. He came to our public forum. His words were what gave us hope and strength when, as happened rather often, we were ready to give up. Relentless pressure, relentlessly applied. Another lifelong pro at activism, who I met during this time, famous for her many arrests and dedication to all that is good and righteous, Louise Ramirez Steinbeck, told me at her 90th birthday party, "Never let them bother you." These are wise words, since growing a thick skin and much determination is essential, especially since being called an activist in today's world often triggers negative responses. Unfortunately, but whatever it is that moves you, makes you want to change the world, even in the smallest way, then it is definitely something worth doing, in spite of the obstacles. I never expected to become an expert in incineration operations, yet I learned so I could be credible, and so can everyone else. I have even received some calls from as far away as Hawaii regarding incineration, and it never ceases to amaze me how very few real experts there are. Credibility is of foremost importance. The days of thinking of activism as long-haired, as a profession for long-haired hippies, are over. The activist of today uses the internet, and age and ability to march holding up signs in pouring rain is basically not an issue anymore. What is absolutely essential is to find the truth and stick to it. Credibility and success will come with it. Words are powerful tools, and credibility and truth are absolutely essential to mention as often as possible. There are no compromises to be made when it comes to truth, but there is a generosity that has to come by using it, and that is that you're supposed to allow everyone the chance to save face, to walk away with dignity in spite of what they have done, to maybe even give them a chance to repent of what they have done on their own time. It became increasingly difficult to do that because we attended public meetings where the speakers were blatantly telling lies. Not asking them to please stop lying would have been a fatal mistake, because otherwise those words would go on record and people would take it as the truth. It is absolutely imperative that when one hears a lie, to correct that lie before it becomes the written word. A very prominent, well-thought-of person at NIH came to the library where we had planned a meeting. He stood up, he talked. What he said was riddled with wrong things. He sat, listened, and there were many people there who had never heard the story before. So this was a great opportunity for him to spread something that, whether he thought of it as being the truth or not, was not the issue. But it was not the truth. It was his version of it. Maybe he thought it. Maybe he was paid to say those words. I will never know. But I stood up. I said, please, Dr. such and such, we would like to have somebody come to the podium who does know the correct answers. You're not an expert in this field. Please go and sit down. And he did. Clearly, without personal insults, which the other side will always use against you. I was insulted in a way that was totally foreign to me. My mother at this point was very ill and dying, and I had to leave to take care of her. And upon my return, one of the people on the NIH committee said, well, I'm sure glad you're back. I'm sure this is your number one priority. And becoming an activist oftentimes is what we're driven to do. We don't choose it. We happen to fall into it. We happen to be at a certain place at a right time for us to do the job, because nobody else picks up the pieces to do them. So it is not of our choosing, and I strongly believe it is the man upstairs who tells us the time and place. Take a car in sunlight and take the color of a car at nighttime. Oftentimes those colors are different. I have a silver-colored car. It looks golden in bright sunshine, and at night it looks almost white. The truth can have two different looks to different people. We can't always think that people are lying. They may just be seeing things from a different angle. As we were working on this, I also became an expert in documentation. To be credible, you have to have documents. You have to be able to find the primary documents that lead to the answers that you can present. And I brought with me today a couple of things, and you're welcome to browse this table later. But there are newspaper articles here. If you ever see something in a newspaper article that is totally incorrect and you as an expert know the difference, call the journalist. It is only a phone call away. The Washington Post, every journalist's name is listed. You can dial them direct. Set the story straight. These are young kids that are writing these stories. Oftentimes they don't know the whole story. They don't have time to research out every topic. They're very happy when somebody calls them and tells them, hey, I've got this document for you. I think you ought to glance at it. And next time, please don't write that way. It does make a difference. And it does make the world a better place, because truth in the media is absolutely something that is going by the wayside. freedom of speech. Allow people to speak their piece. Allow people to say what they think without ridicule, without making them their enemy. But be able to go out on your front yard and fly a peace flag if you want to, without the fear of having it replaced at nighttime with an American flag, and vice versa. Stand for freedom. But freedom is not flying the flag to show your support for a war. When I came to this country, I was an immigrant. The flag stood for freedom. It stood for something that I've always wanted as my symbol of a journey. Austria is very democratic. I didn't leave a starving nation. I came from a long culture that goes back 1,000 years. This country has existed, known by the same name, through different governments. But I've never been prouder to be anything but American. But when I see the flags only being flown as a pro-war statement, it makes me ill. Because those flags should stand for everything that's good about this country and not for something that could harm someone. It has always been a haven for those trying to escape from places that were in turmoil. It also should never have to fear for punishment. So this is something that I think is very integral, that we're losing some of this ability to express ourselves without the fear of some sort of repercussion. Where were we? There are also many, many other facts which make us choose that writing a check is easier, mailing it to some mailbox in Jersey or somewhere, so that somebody chooses some African place to do some good in. It's our personal preferences, it's our personality, it's the wimp factor. We don't want to face hardships. Many meetings I've attended, government meetings and in private, I've noticed some people who always stand in the back of the room. That used to be me. When the topic became uncomfortable, I was gone. I was history. I was out that door. Easy to walk away. We all have our comfort perimeters, and fortunately, they do change depending on what our Father in Heaven has in store for us. Do any of you know what downwinders are? I think you do. I'm one, and most likely, so are you. Let me get to that. Let me show you something. Many years ago, in the 1950s, and how are we doing on time? Okay. Back in the 1950s, the United States government started nuclear tests on the continent of America. What resulted was this. Simple cause and effect. What came out in 1997 was a report by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, by the Cancer Institute. It says, estimated exposures and thyroid doses received by the American people from I-131 in fallout following Nevada atmospheric nuclear bomb tests. This was a report that took 14 years to write. 14 years earlier, Congress mandated that this report be written because of hearings and revelations at that time that this harmed the American public, each and every one. We're the number one country in the world where childhood thyroid cancer Why? We're the only other places that have such an increase are very isolated regions. Kazakhstan has the only other test site in the world that had the same type of releases as the Nevada. I-131 is a radioactive isotope that occurs when atom bombs are exploded. A dirty bomb does not hold I-131. Those iodine pills that you see advertised today, they will not help you. It is only if a nuclear bomb goes off. And in that case, I don't think a pill is going to save anyone. Many books have been written. This is part of our history that has been buried. It is silence, it is invisible, and nobody knows about these things. This is why I started an organization called SERVE. It's Support and Education for Radiation Victims. And that is something that there was a huge void in. There was nobody who talked to these people who are still dying today. In 2000, a compensation bill was passed by our government. And this just came out in April of this year. It says, radiation exposure compensation. Funding to pay claims may be inadequate to meet projected needs. So between the year, actually the compensation bill, the original one, was passed in 1990. We amended it with the help of some Navajos. We were able to push through an amendment to it, which included more counties and more cancers. The most prevalent cancers were never included in the original compensation bill, were excluded, the most common radiological cancers. But isn't this interesting, that they're still believing that the funding from now on is still inadequate for this, which means that a lot of people have applied since the year 2000, since those prevalent cancers had been added to the compensation bill. Compensation bill, if some of you don't know, is $50,000 for a person's life. It doesn't take into consideration who they were, what they did, or how much their medical expenses were. It's a one-time thing, and their medical expenses are not taken care of. What falls also into this category is the atomic workers, who now have a compensation bill in place. The miners, the uranium miners, who also now have a compensation bill in place that pays them up to $150,000 compensation. The workers get $75,000. The atomic veterans get also $75,000. But the downwinders, women, children, and civilians that were exposed, still only get $50,000. Hatch did not do a good job with that one. When his office is called, oftentimes by people who need help with the compensation packet, I brought one today just to show you. It's a very simple forward packet if anyone wants to look at it. But Hatch's office oftentimes claims that they don't know what people are talking about. I could get on the phone right now, call his office, and I say, I would like to know about the compensation bill. And whoever answers the phone will say, well, we don't know anything about it. Call the Justice Department. And then the Justice Department says, call Senator Hatch's office. So that is part of activism, helping people just find the answers. Let me see. Okay. Just a quick overview. In the 1950s, the U.S. government started to test atom bombs. Scientists warned the military about the possible harm and even sent memos stating that the chickens will come home to roost regarding radioactive fallout and its deadly consequences. There's a good one. Medical professionals, many in the scientific community, and even some in Government officials tried to point out the danger of exploding nuclear weapons within just a few miles of women and children. The unbelievable fact that over 200,000 American soldiers were marched into ground zero, into fallout clouds, through heavily contaminated dirt, and actually had their clothing burned into their skin on these maneuvers has been written about in many books and is well documented in the Atomic Energy Commission documents, which I became rather addicted to. At least a million pages of horrific evidence, declassified fairly recently under Hazel O'Leary, proved that the U.S. government conducted over 4,000 human radiation experiments, which included mentally ill at the Fernald Institute, Utah prisoners, pregnant women in Rhode Island, conscientious objectors at Army medical centers who were fed plutonium-laced food, patients at the University of Utah Medical Center. One experiment even went so far as to solicit the help of Utah morticians and doctors to collect bone and tissue samples from dead infants and children without informing the parents. This project was rather shockingly called Project Sunshine. I do not even want to try to explain what made doctors and morticians of Mormon faith insult the sacredness of the human body and the trust of the parents in such a crude and heartless manner. Their alliance was obviously to an entity other than what their religion, morality, and ethics would dictate. Thousands of Utah bomb victims have died and are still dying. No help or assistance or organized outreach exists for them. When it was made so that the last compensation amendment included $5 million for outreach and grassroots, that money was given to the Public Health Service to distribute. Who did they distribute to? It was not to the grassroots people. It was to government agencies. Nobody holds their feet to the fire. And when Hatch was asked about this, he says, well, those are good groups too, aren't they? Maybe they're too close. Why are we ignoring what is among us, what maybe is affecting us, ourselves? Maybe it hits too close to home. Maybe our own comfort zone has been invaded, and truth can be painful, especially when it hits ourselves. My sister-in-law, my friend, a successful assistant U.S. attorney in Salt Lake City, Utah, died of radiation exposure 10 years ago. Things like this change one's life. Regardless of faith in God, the loss is indescribable. She asked me simply to forget when she was dying. I now talk to the people that are just like her almost every day. I founded this organization I just called you about. As a result, I was invited 2 years ago to Japan to come and speak in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We were on a train traveling from Hiroshima. I had just given my talk. Beautiful air-conditioned train. The landscape was rushing by. I could not resist the memory of what it would have been like on that hot August day when children and mothers who were shopping, children who were playing 55 years earlier, were basically incinerated in this horrible Holocaust, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The train was full of speakers. One was from Australia, and we were visiting with all of them. After a few hours after we arrived that evening, we went out to dinner and ran into our newfound Australian friend, who asked us if he could spend the evening with us. He told us that he had a gift for us. This gift was this poem, which he had written on the train after meeting us and hearing of what happened in Nevada in 1955. He had never heard the story before, and he wanted to give us this. The bomb was created, it was tested and used, its effects were known, yet knowingly it was used and used again, secretly under the guise of tests. It was used and people died. This was murder. There are laws against murder. But no one went to go for this massacre of the innocents. The serial killers walk proud and free, feted and rewarded for their devotion to duty, defenders of the realm. So what of those who haven't died? What happened to them? No pains are spared to cover up their plight, to deny responsibility, to deprive them of all avenues of redress, and when all else fails, sovereign immunity is invoked. For those unversed in legal jargon, this is a system devised for the protection of tyrants. Let me put a spin on this to explain a system with sanctions and reward, which sanctions and rewards mass murder. People are reduced to objects, to be manipulated, used, and controlled. Without taking this first step of objectification, none of the rest can follow. I would leave it at that, but I feel obliged to add that I regularly objectify my fellow human beings. I don't commit mass murder, but I always pay a price. In objectifying others, I dehumanize myself and construct an impenetrable barrier between myself and them. I suffer instantly and continuously, as long as the objectification and the barrier remain. I might hope that the tyrants suffer more, but I don't assume this to be so. Nevertheless, I know that objectification is the first and final injustice that I must address. Philip White, Nagasaki, 7th of August, 2000. This was written to honor all victims of nuclear tests. And what he wrote was thanks to Denise Nelson and Dennis Nelson from CERV for this inspiration. This was one of the most special gifts that anyone has given me. In time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act, said by George Orwell. And whether you choose to spend your time volunteering for the environment, for human rights, for health issues, for civil rights, or any other subject that moves you. For example, Alice Hemming in my ward just did a tremendous art show in the Mormon Visitor Center at the temple. Something moved her to do that. This is an act of activism. This is an act of making the world more beautiful, more worthwhile, more something that God would love and smile at. Don't straddle the fence. Stick to the truth always, but allow others to save face. Never endanger yourself or anyone else physically. This is God's body. He gave it to you. Protect it. Next time, wrongly about an issue, erase the feeling of failure. Reject it from your thoughts. And fear not. That is the ultimate line. And do whatever needs to be done to improve the world around you. It's something not to be missed at any price. Thank you.
Thank you, Denise. I think we as Americans and as members of the church owe people like you, and especially you individually, a great debt of gratitude for standing up and setting an example for all of us, because there is so much that needs to be done, and we are all so busy and so involved and so overwhelmed that rarely do we do what we would like to do or what needs to happen. And your example has been an inspiration. So I think we have a couple of minutes. Does anyone have a question or would like to raise an issue with Denise? Well, I have. You made a couple of points that really impressed me and stuck out particularly. And one of the things that you said that was most impressive is that you were standing up for what you believe and being true to yourself. And I think often we are lured away by fear or being overwhelmed to not participate and not do something just because it's going to be uncomfortable, it's going to be unpopular, or it's something that we're really not convinced about within ourselves. We don't have that conviction. And what I was impressed with was the fact that you weren't convinced of any particular thing when you started out, but you did make the first step, and that you did expand your understanding and your impressions and follow what you felt in your heart. And I think that often we stop at that point and don't take that first step. So, and also I thought, this is totally contrary to the other things that you said. Usually people join the church, they get married, they raise their children, they're happy, and they're content with that level. And the fact that you almost sound like forced by something inside yourself to go beyond that. That was very impressive to me.
Can I make a reply?
You may make. Absolutely.
A couple of things. I think it's in the genetics. My grandmother was an active woman until she was in her 90s, and I think that I have inherited a little bit of her trait. But I wanted to mention what you said was very kind. Thank you very much. But it's perfectly acceptable to find what we're comfortable with. I've talked to so many groups of people, and people say always, oh, I'm much more comfortable, you know, doing the Africa thing. And there's nothing wrong with that, as long as we're very careful and not just throw money away. All of us who are here today obviously see Sunstone as a worthwhile activity. And so the next time you donate something or you want to do some good, you know, I wasn't hired by Sunstone, but I will give them a plug. They're a great organization. And let's focus in a little bit on what makes us feel good. Those are the organizations. Those are the activities that there's nothing wrong with for us to support and to step out a little bit beyond our little comfort plane and to try to make a difference with those. I think that's a great way to start for people who are not comfortable in walking down Pennsylvania Avenue screaming and shouting, which I've also done, just because I wanted to experience these things. I wanted to know what it was like. I told my husband once a few years ago, I don't want to die without ever having had a dog. And so we got a dog. But you have to go out there, experience this, and find what incredible treasures some of these people are. Never lose your caution, because they're professional demonstrators. They're professional activists who will railroad. Yes, and con artists. Yes.
I was wondering, you seem to be very balanced on this, which is impressive. But
thank you.
I have had a couple of occasions where I have had interaction with activists.
Yes.
And people that are shutting down whole cities or whatever.
Yes.
For their issues.
Well, right. Right. Okay. What I have seen and experienced firsthand is that there are professional activists who actually destroy the cause. And what is even more curious, and I hate to go as far as saying they're paid by some government agency, because that would sound paranoid. But I have seen the same activists at different marches, carrying different signs, being destructive. And one starts to wonder where their income is coming from. Because just recently I was at a rally on the steps of one of the congressional buildings, and I recognized someone who was causing a real big disturbance. I mean, they were dressed in female clothing, being a man, causing a ruckus. The police, you know, was very calm. But the same person I had seen at the Nagasaki Day, very peaceful demonstration, playing a drunk. So don't be surprised if some of these things are not caused to destroy what people who, with good intentions, are working so hard toward. Yes?
I have a hard time articulating this,
And I didn't want to badger a government that I dearly love, but it is the people I love. Yeah. Yes, entities. What we've encouraged some teachers to do is teach it in school, because government is not going to be the ones forthcoming. If I put up a trap and I trapped something, am I going to admit to having heard it? You know, it's like you can't make the turtle run 60 miles an hour. Most of the people who started this are long gone. They're not the same people that are there today. And to say government as a whole is very, you know, just like you mentioned. Right.
I myself
have benefited. Yes. You know, there's a very easy answer to all of this. The answer is, let's not institutionalize deeds. Never tell something is done by a group of people. Every action in this world is done by an individual. And they are uniquely accountable for their own actions. What is the worst problem about downwinders is that they've never been able to heal. They've never been able to put that person who did it to them behind bars and see justice done. There's a total lack of justice, and a total lack of justice is what hurts people the most, and they carry that with them because their suffering has not been acknowledged legally as being truly something tremendous. And let's have some heroes in our life, and they may well be government associated. I can, you know, probably name a half a dozen of people that work for government, that are in government, that are truly my heroes. But let's also not forget that the person who basically spends 1 hour a week volunteering on something they really strongly believe, those are my heroes. It's not the stories we hear on TV about the person who has recovered from a drug addiction. That doesn't make them a hero to me. The heroes are those that said no in the first place. The heroes are those who just go on with daily life when it becomes unbearable. And the heroes are the downwinders in this case. They made a tremendous sacrifice for this country, and the justice hasn't been done, but it all goes back to the individual. We need to, you know, look at individuals' deeds and hold their feet to the fire. Because if somebody has duly done something evil, they cannot repent for it unless we expose that. We're doing them a favor. We're giving them the chance. It's not something where people say, oh, this is God's will. This is a crutch. God's will is not complicity. Does that answer somewhat? It was a group of people. There was a selected few who knew all the details, the medical consequences and everything, and they still went ahead. Edward Teller is one of them. Oppenheimer was not. It's clear as that. When you read the histories, the memoirs, the stories, you know who was who stood for what, and who sold people out for benefit of money, power, prestige. And there is a, well, I won't go into it. I think we're out of time.
We are out of time, and I'm sorry, because I think we're now to the point where we could have a very interesting discussion, and we could all benefit from this topic and also how this topic could apply to other situations in our lives, how we can all make a contribution positively for causes that are important. But Denise, thank you so much. This was a wonderful opportunity to hear you and hear these topics and to become acquainted with this issue. So thank you very much.